Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sweltering summer climes of Japan, Western Japan, here in July of 2024. My, how time flies. We're halfway through the year, if you can believe that. But here we are. And we have another edition of Questions for Corbett. As usual, you send in the questions, I provide the answers. This time, we're going to take our cue from the Corbett Report July open thread, which, as you know by now, Corbett Report members invited to log in and leave their thoughts, comments, suggestions, questions, links to information that they want to discuss, etc., whatever. And many, 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 many dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of comments have been left, including this one, which is where we're going to take today's question from. AnCap94 writes, I've been diving into 9/11 truth lately, and one main thing still puzzles me. How did they rig the Twin Towers with explosives? I mean, as far as I can tell, there were explosives not only in the base of the buildings, but the upper floors as well. But I can't seem to find any material explaining how this was done. Thanks in advance. All right. Thank you for the question, AnCap94. And thank you to the Corbett Report members who did hop in to provide some form of answer to that question. And as usual, Home Remedy Supply with a very helpful suggestion here. He says, there's definitely material out there on the topic. I don't have time to wade through stuff. James Corbett would be your go-to man. Yeah, well, okay, thank you. And Richard Grove and Kevin Ryan probably have some interesting information on that. And he gives a link to 9/11 Blogger, specifically 9/11 Blogger posts related to Kevin Ryan. Okay, yes, you've got the right, at least general suggestion there, Home Remedy Supply. Although it is interesting to note, not a single member really has the answer, and there is a very, very specific answer to this very, very specific question. Who could have had access to the World Trade Center buildings? How could they have possibly been rigged beforehand? Well, there is research on that. Very, very, very good research from, as Home Remedy Supply suggested, Kevin Ryan, who is a researcher that I hope my audience is familiar with. I've cited his work specifically on 9/11 many, many times over the years. So let's cite it again. This time we're going to turn to his four-part, extremely exhaustive, very well-documented, meticulously footnoted article series on demolition access to the WTC towers, which actually consists of four different parts. Part one is about tenants, part two is about security, part three, convergence, and part four, cleanup. And these are not little articles. These are deep dive, extremely intensive articles. So in order to get an idea of what it is, let's just look at the introduction to part one here, where he quotes Bush's famous, let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories about the events of 9/11 quote. And then he goes on to say, one important way to see the false nature of Bush's conspiracy theory is to note the fact that the World Trade Center buildings could only have fallen as they did through the use of explosives. A number of independent scientific studies have pointed out this fact. Hyperlink 1, 2, 3, 4. There are some footnotes for you. But it was Bush's own scientists at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, through their inability to provide a convincing defense of the official line, who ultimately proved that explosives were necessary. Footnotes 2, 5, 6, and 7. All right, this leads us to ask the obvious question, the one that I think AnCap94 is at least gesturing towards there. Who could have placed explosives in the World Trade Center towers, and how, is part of that question. To answer that question, we should first consider who had access to the buildings, specifically the areas of the buildings that would be relevant to a demolition operation. We should also consider the time periods of interest. Those who had access at the necessary times should be further considered in terms of their ability to obtain the necessary explosive technologies and expertise, their ability to be secretive, and the possibility that they could have benefited from the destruction of the WTC buildings or from the resulting war on terror. But one thing is certain, unless it was done by one person acting alone, it must have been a conspiracy. The Twin Towers and WTC-7, all highly secure buildings, were most readily accessed by tenants, security, and building management staff, and construction-related contractors. So then he starts diving into it, and he puts the time frame of where we're going to look for these areas of interest and who might have had access, the years between the 1993 WTC bombing and September 11th, 2001. It's an arbitrary time distinction there, but I think it's one way to keep this manageable. As you will see, this is already an incredibly large deep dive, so I think 8 years of looking through records is important. He does talk about what kinds of things he's looking at here, including modifications that did happen to the WTC structure over those years. Modifications included upgrades to electrical, fire protection, and elevator systems, as well as general construction activities. And as a rule, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey was responsible for initiating the modifications in the public access areas. Meanwhile, the tenants themselves were responsible for completing the modifications throughout the leased spaces. So it matters who's leased in what floors and in what way and that sort of thing. So he starts getting into it, talking first about the North Tower, between which was impacted, as we all saw, between floors 94 and 99. In a stunning coincidence, these floors bracket those that had been upgraded for fireproofing shortly before 9/11. What a coinkydink. Imagine that. This coincidence was amplified by the fact that one tenant occupied all of those floors. Remember, we just established that in the leased space, the tenants were responsible for the handling the upgrades and modifications. Well, in this case, it was a single tenant in those impacted areas, Marsh & McLennan, a company whose name should be ringing a bell if you've watched any of my 9/11 coverage, which at the time was the world's largest insurance brokerage company. One other tenant, Sumitomo Bank, shared part of floor 96 with Marsh. During the years from 1993 to 2001, Marsh made several modifications to these floors, in addition to the fireproofing upgrades mentioned above. According to NIST, Marsh made modifications to the south side of floor 94 in 1998. That same year, the Port Authority helped Marsh demolish floors 95 to 98 in order to rebuild the fire alarm and sprinkler systems. Marsh did further modification work on floor 95 in the year 2000. The full floor fireproofing upgrades on floors 90 through 100 were accomplished in August through November of 1998, except for floor 94, which was done in December of 1996. And then he starts going on to talk about Marsh and its, as a company, its various directors and executives. For example, its chief executive on 9/11 was Jeffrey Greenberg. Greenberg. Hammer and Hank Greenberg? Yeah, I think might be a relation. Member of the Brookings Institution, the Trilateral Commission, and the son of the chairman of American International Group, Maurice Hammer and Hank Greenberg. AIG has been reported to be at the center of a number of CIA operations. And again, footnotes everywhere. So there's lots and lots and lots of follow-up reading and research for people to do. He talks more about Jeffrey Greenberg and his association with BCCI. He goes on to talk about other very powerful and well-connected people who worked in senior management at Marsh, including Stephen Friedman, a senior principal at Marsh Capital and former partner at Goldman Sachs, who later became George W. Bush's top economic advisor. What a small world. Friedman was also a member of the Brookings Institution, the Bilderberg Group, the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and the board at InQtel, the investment firm founded by the CIA in 98. And if you don't know about InQtel, well, I just recently posted up a flashback to my 2011 report on Meet InQtel, the CIA's venture capital firm, where you can find out more about that. So lots of information, lots of juicy links, and how Friedman was connected through Quill and Dagger, which, yeah, is one of those skull and bones type secret societies that infest the American Ivy League network, connected through Quill and Dagger to people like, oh, Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz, Sandy Berger. Remember Sandy Berger stealing records from the 9/11 Commission? Stephen Hadley. Again, names that should be familiar. If not, there's plenty of information in this article about them. He talks about the president of Marsh Real Estate Advisors, at least in that period from 98 to 2001, who just happened to be the husband of George W. Bush's cousin, Dorothy Walker Bush. Wow, again, what a small world. And that is not the first Bush cousin that we're going to meet in this exploration. And then he gets on to another interesting person in the Marsh stable at that time in September 2001, specifically L. Paul Bremer. He says, add to this, L. Paul Bremer and the possible Marsh ties to demolition technology become clearer. And he goes on to talk about Bremer and his connections. Now, again, this should be something that hopefully, hopefully, you don't even have to be a longtime viewer. You will remember the very previous edition of Questions for Corbett, Clearing the Decks, where I was asked a question about people like Bremer, and I went through and talked and showed how to find more information about Bremer and his potential connections to 9/11. So, again, hopefully you've already seen and gone through that, but if not, well, don't worry. There's plenty more information in this article about Bremer and his potential links to what happened on 9/11. And for those who would like to hear Kevin Ryan talking more about Marsh, about Bremer, and about this 9/11 incident, Kevin Ryan was interviewed in 2021 on the Richard Gage Unleashed podcast, where he was talking specifically about this Part 1 article on the demolition access to the World Trade Center.
One thing that drew my attention in 2008 was a strange correlation between the fireproofing upgrades that were going on in the few years before 9/11 and where they occurred. And it turned out, you know, I drew a diagram of this kind of showing that where the fireproofing upgrades occurred just happened to be exactly where the planes impacted, exactly where these weird fires were occurring, and they matched up perfectly. I mean, in the North Tower, it was exact. It was exact. So the,
wow.
Floors 92 to 100, for example, were upgraded for fireproofing. That's exactly where the plane hit the building. Those floors were all occupied by a company called Marsh & McLennan. And Marsh & McLennan was this huge conglomerate. It had various insurance and other financial interests. And one of the employees for Marsh & McLennan drew my attention. He actually had an office in the South Tower. So he wasn't actually at the office that day. He miraculously survived. But this is a guy that people know. His name is L. Paul Bremer. And L. Paul Bremer was a longtime expert on terrorism back to his days as managing director of Kissinger Associates, and then later leading several commissions investigating the official myths of terrorism, Al-Qaeda and such. But on 9/11, L. Paul Bremer was the head of Marsh Crisis. So basically a division of Marsh that prepared for, well, frankly, exactly these kinds of events. And so it was very interesting to me that this Marsh & McLennan occupied all the floors that were exactly where the fireproofing upgrade has occurred in the North Tower. And one of their executives had an office in the South Tower. And you may remember that on the day of 9/11, it was L. Paul Bremer who showed up on the news telling us exactly what happened. He knew the whole story. It was Osama bin Laden. You know, the buildings couldn't withstand the stress and such. And so we had to go after Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And just remarkable. You know, but other things about Bremer that drew my attention was he was a director of some interesting companies, including one that had patented a thermite demolition device.
Oh.
So, yeah, it was a subsidiary of Dresser Industries. If you remember Dresser Industries, this was a company that George H.W. Bush had worked with in his days as a CIA business asset. So it's basically a CIA business company, Dresser Industries, related to the oil and gas industry. But Komatsu Dresser, which is a construction subsidiary of Dresser, had Bremer on its board, and also they had patented a thermite demolition device in 1998. So these things just start to adding up to me with, you know, suspicion. At this point, there are a lot of just strings, you know, pulling together. Necessarily saying that L. Paul Bremer planted explosives in the World Trade Center, but, you know, frankly, it's very suspicious that the company would occupy the exact floors that were fireproofing upgrades occurred and where the plane crashed. And their executive, who didn't show up at the office, ended up telling us what happened on TV that day. People may know L. Paul Bremer better as being the occupation governor of Iraq. So he worked for Donald Rumsfeld right after that period of time. And he was instilled as the governor of Iraq under occupation.
An incredible series of coincidences.
Some interesting pieces of the puzzle, I think you'll agree. And yes, there seem to be a few things in the L. Paul Bremer story that indicate that that would be a thread worth following for enterprising researchers in the crowd or any aspiring lawyers who want to bring attorneys general or others that want to bring actual court action about 9/11. This might be someone you'd like to subpoena, that you'd like to testify. So, at any rate, there's much more info and, of course, links and footnotes here in this article if you want to continue following that. But then, after talking about the North Tower, of course, we move over to the South Tower, in which we observe that the impact took place between floors 78 and 83, and who was occupying those floors? Well, Baseline Financial Services was located on floors 77 and 78, Fuji Bank was on floor 79 to 82, and Aeon Corporation was on floor 83. And then he begins breaking it down. For example, Baseline Financial, was led by a very interesting individual named Joseph Casputis. And then he goes through Casputis' interesting history and his connections to the Department of Energy and developing thermite ignition devices at the DOE. Not necessarily that Casputis was personally involved in that, but anyway. Maybe just a tangential coincidence. And he goes through, again, much, much more detail about Casputis, about that company, about Fuji Bank and its connections and its director's connections to Deutsche Bank, etc. He's now on the board of Deutsche Bank, or at least in 2009 was, when Kevin Ryan wrote this article, etc., etc. Again, much more information. BCCI again coming up. Tons more information. The Boston Globe reported that Prescott Bush Jr. had also been a business partner with Tokyo-based Aoki Construction Corp. Interesting. All right. Et cetera, et cetera. Moving to floor 83, there was Aeon Corporation, which, oh, by the way, yes, the most interesting character working for Aeon was Jim Pierce, the cousin of George W. Bush, another Bush cousin. Wow, what a small world. And still not the last Bush cousin that we could talk about with regards to 9/11. Anyway. An unusual feature. I thought this was interesting. Maybe tangential to the question at hand, but I thought it was interesting. An unusual feature of the destruction of the South Tower was the cold spot on the north face of the building. This section along a 12-column area of floors 80, 81, 82 did not experience any fire, despite the fact that the areas on both sides did have fire. And he does mentioned the NIST report concluding that insufficient information is available to allow a likely formation mechanism for the cold spot to be postulated, or, translating from the scientific technobabble there, it's just, we don't know. It's like their report on how the Twin Towers came down. Well, and then global collapse ensued. And then a miracle occurred. Again, all right. Plenty more information. And then he goes on, after going through the South Tower and those tenants that were in that impact area, then he starts talking about, well, if a top-down demolition were implemented in the WTC's Twin Towers on 9/11, then it would have been necessary to plant explosives on floors below the impact zone. From a novice perspective, it would seem ideal to have planted such explosives at regular intervals below the impact area, around floor 50, for example, and below that, around floor 25 to 35, and lower. Videos show squibs emanating in these general areas of each tower at levels spaced between the mechanical floors on 41, 42, and 75, 76. And then he starts to go through some of those tenants on some of those other floors and how they're connected in, some of them, to the aforementioned Marsh and other companies that we've looked at before, and some other companies with their connections. Then he moves on to conclusions and next steps, in which he notes that connections to organizations that had access to explosives materials and to the expertise required to use explosives keep coming up in this exploration, which is interesting at the very least, if not conclusive. And then he says, it seems that if certain management representatives of the tenant companies listed above wanted to help bring the WTC towers down, they would have been well suited to do so. After having going, when you go through all of this information and all of the intelligence connections and Defense Department connections and other shady connections that these various executives of these tenants on these particular floors had, you will doubtless reach the same conclusion. There are also strong connections to those who benefited from the 9/11 attacks. And so there we're talking about not only, of course, the Bush family and their corporate network, but also the various companies that were invested, connected or invested or partnered with Raytheon and other defense contractors and things like that. Again, there's a lot of material here, as I think you can see, even just by whizzing through it like this. And oh yeah, down at the bottom, you get to the footnotes, and there's 63 of them to go through. So literally, you could spend a good solid month if you really wanted to deep dive into this and go into every link and every connection and really explore this material. There's a lot there for you, but oh boy, we're only actually just getting started. Anyway, so after having read part one, which I trust you will do after this episode, you might still be asking yourself, so what does this have to do with the price of tea in China? What is it about fireproofing upgrades that somehow prove what? Explosive demolition access? How does this work? You may have questions about this. Well, later on in that same aforementioned 2021 podcast interview between Richard Gage and Kevin Ryan, Kevin Ryan does elaborate on that very question.
You know, the reason fireproofing upgrades are so important is because that allowed the structural steel to be revealed. You know, in order to do the fireproofing upgrades, you had to uncover the structural steel. And so, you know, what could have been done at, you know, in order to facilitate the crimes of 9/11 by removing the fireproofing and upgrading the fireproofing on the steel. Well, you know, one thing that many of us believe is true is that the planes were in fact hijacked. They were hijacked remotely, and that, you know, the planes were then flew into their targets remotely by military capable people who were using what was then proven technology. I mean, they could fly a large airliner by remote control technology into an exact location, and that was being shown. I think one researcher who's done a lot of work, you may invite him eventually on this, is Aidan Monahan, and he did a lot of good work in investigating the technologies related to this remote control of these large airliners. But, you know, if there needed to be beacons, for example, placed in the buildings in places where people wouldn't know where they were, that's an example of what fireproofing upgrades could have allowed. Another thing would be the application of particularly nanothermite type materials. So, you know, nanothermite, something that I've made myself in my own garage, and it's not easy to make. It's difficult to make, but if you get the right components together and you follow a formulation, formulations are published, for example, by the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I made some based on one of their formulations. And, you know, this is a sol gel material. So back in the early years, you know, we wondered about how thermite could have been applied if it was applied. And in some cases, we feel like it was applied through a sol gel coating. And so sol gel is the basis for nanothermite formulations in many cases. And so, you know, applying this material under the fireproofing, for example, is an example of what could have been done. Oh. And yeah, so, you know, I think people misunderstand that to mean that we feel like nanothermite was the only explosive or incendiary material used in the World Trade Center. That's not what any of us have ever said that they're aware of. And so really we feel like explosives were placed throughout the buildings, but thermite materials were placed in specific locations. So the core columns needed to be weakened. They were huge, massive columns, and they needed to be weakened. So thermite is an example of what could do that. And then also fires needed to occur beyond the time that they would have actually occurred. So if people haven't thought about this, you know, explosions like a jet fuel fire impact explosion is something that consumes all the oxygen in the area. And basically everybody, including the government, if you don't know, agree that the jet fuel fires burned off in just a couple of minutes. So jet fuel fires were not what caused the World Trade Center to
Well, even NIST acknowledges that. The jet fuel burned up, they say it in 10 minutes. Most of it burned up outside. 90% of it burned up outside the buildings, they said. And the rest of it was gone in 10 minutes. So for the next hour or hour and a half, you have normal office fires that were lit by jet fuel, which is essentially kerosene, right?
Exactly. So this is the thing. The fires, though, you know, they went out. So if you remember in the 1993 invasion of Iraq, the way Saddam Hussein retreated was he set all the oil wells on fire. And just stay with me here for a minute. But the way we put them out is the way people put them out was let explosives off at the point of the fire, because explosives would consume all the oxygen, and then the fires would go out. And the jet fuel explosions at the World Trade Center did the same thing. And if you watch over time, the buildings burning, the fires actually went out almost. They went very, very low after the plane impact. But then they started up again and they raged. They actually raged around the buildings. And then the points opposite impact, they were raging fires again. So, you know, how could that happen? In my opinion, you know, people didn't intend to just demolish the World Trade Center buildings. I think that's clear. They intended to provide a psychological trauma to people. They intended to provide a show that would stay with people, and that required fire to continue. In my opinion, nanothermite, one of the uses of nanothermite was in those areas where they needed fire to continue. They needed to show on TV that fires were burning when really they didn't have enough fire load on those floors for it to burn very long. But nanothermite would have burned. It would have melted steel. We saw molten metal falling from the buildings, as you've shown many times before. And so the application of this nanothermite in those areas, I think, was part of how that happened.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Now, you mentioned that nanothermite or thermite and or thermite were probably not the only technologies. And I agree with you. And I just wanted to add that we have eight ton structural steel sections ejected laterally out of the towers at 80 miles an hour, clocked by physicists, landing 600 feet in every direction. This is an incredible explosive force. And we've always been saying that there's most likely high energy explosives. And yet we keep getting criticized by a small element of the 9/11 truth community for exaggerating the explosiveness of thermite or nanothermite. When, like you said, this is not our only thesis. And I have told some of these people personally several times that this is a straw man attack against those of us who are exposing the forensic evidence of thermite. Do you have any other comments on that issue?
Well, yeah, you know, we see a lot of the straw man attacks, you know, people who try to present our information as claims in specific ways. And, you know, that has gone on for years, ever since I've been involved. And it's a misdirection. And, you know, frankly, it just causes more confusion and doesn't help. But I think that's the intention in some cases. So I've never said that nanothermite was the only thing used to bring down the World Trade Centers. I don't believe that at all. I believe that molecular explosives like HMX, for example, were also used. And, you know, people ask, well, you've tested the World Trade Center dust for the thermitic materials. We have found thermitic materials scattered throughout the World Trade Center dust. Has anybody tested the World Trade Center dust for residues from explosive materials? And I can say that I have not done that. I think it's possible to do that. I don't know what the outcome would be.
Well, let me say this. NIST actually said that they found no residue of explosives in the World Trade Center dust or steel. And a year later, they acknowledge in writing that they never looked for it.
Right. So they admitted after they said that, that no, we didn't actually test for it. Of course, you're not going to find what you don't test for.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's possible to do chromatography testing, for example, of World Trade Center dust samples and possibly find trace amounts of residues from molecular explosives, although it may not be possible as well.
Can you explain molecular explosives versus high energy explosives?
Right. So I call them molecular explosives. So like HMX, for example, is an example of what I would call molecular explosive. But, you know, there's high-tech technology that, you know, the national laboratories and military had been examining at the time. But, you know, one thing about access to the World Trade Center towers in terms of demolition, you know, there are other kind of red herring stories, I believe, that relate to, you know, kind of hint at the idea that somebody was there putting explosives in. For example, they talk about moving vans running around the area and maybe they had bunches of explosives who came that day and planted them all. And, it's the placement of explosives for demolition. I think, Richard, you may be able to speak better than I can about this after all these years. It doesn't occur overnight. It's not something that happens on the weekend. There may be some final touches, and we've talked about power outages in the days or weeks before 9/11. There may be some final touches, but to actually wire buildings or prepare them for demolition takes quite a long time, and especially huge towers like the ones that fell down on 9/11.
All right. Once again, that was Kevin Ryan talking to Richard Gage on the Richard Gage 911 Unleashed podcast back in 2021 about the demolition access to the World Trade Center article that we just zipped through, or more precisely, part one of that article on the tenants. And there was a lot of information in there. So I hope ANCAP 94 and anyone else who may be just dipping their toes into the waters of 9/11 truth, I hope you had your pen and paper ready there and were taking notes, because there were entire avenues of exploration that were just touched on there in passing that are probably worth your time and attention. Like, for example, that what crazy space-age futuristic hypothetical idea that just sounds completely off the wall of remote controlling airplane? No, that's crazy. Oh, wait, actually, that's well-documented existing technology that existed in 2001. And if you want more information about that, I would highly suggest an interesting nugget from the Corbett Report archives that I think has been largely forgotten over the intervening 13 years, namely interview 293 with the researcher that they mentioned there, Aidan Monahan, who wrote a paper about the very technical analysis of the turning radius of United 175, or at least the data that we were given for that, and how it was incredibly unlikely for such a turn to be completed by a human being. There's a lot of very specific technical data in that conversation and in that paper specifically. So I will, of course, throw the link to that conversation in the show notes, as well as a link to my How to Steal an Airplane from 9/11 to MH370, where I talked about this remote control technology that did exist prior to 9/11. And there's a lot of information there to start getting into. Another thing that was just mentioned in passing in that conversation, but again, is definitely worth more of your time and attention is, oh, by the way, the power down of the World Trade Center that took place the weekend before 9/11, specifically Saturday, September 8th, 2001, and Sunday, September 9th, 2001. There was a complete power down of at least the upper floors of the South Tower. And for people who want more information about that, this is one of those things that I remember having been there a couple of decades ago, following the 9/11 truth movement at that time. I remember this was bread and butter sort of information that everybody in the 9/11 truth space knew and talked about and was widely written about. But for some reason, it's basically forgotten these days. But yes, specifically, I recalled that there was a whistleblower named Scott Forbes, who worked on the 97th floor for Fiduciary Trust, who talked about that power down in the South Tower, in the upper floors, that took place the weekend before, and that he testified there were in retrospect, a number of anomalous things about that. First of all, that it was completely unprecedented for people who don't work in such an environment, especially in the World Trade Center that is processing transactions in real time. A complete power down is a very big issue. It had never been done before in the time, at least, that Scott Forbes had been working in that office. And so they did receive a few weeks' notice of it, and then the power down took place. And as he later testified, there were all sorts of guys in overalls with all sorts of boxes and things going through the space, and who knows, the security systems were down so people could just enter anywhere. It was a highly anomalous event. And I remember Scott Forbes and his testimony. I'll throw in a link, for example, to a George Washington's blog post about an interview they conducted with him. I'll throw in a link to an interview that Jack Blood on Deadline Live did with Scott Forbes that has been preserved. But man, there's all of that information. But I had forgotten, and in the course of preparing this episode, video editor extraordinaire Brock West dug up the other piece of information, because I thought, oh, this was a one-source story, right? It was just Scott Forbes that said that. But no, actually, this story was confirmed by a separate fiduciary trust worker named Gary Corbett, who was interviewed by Gary Franchi, then of the Reality Report, back in 2005 at the 9/11 Truth demonstrations that were taking place in New York at that time. They ran into Gary Corbett, who shared the story that completely confirms and corroborates what Scott Forbes was saying, namely a complete power down, at least in the upper floors of the South Tower, the weekend before 9/11, which, again, seems pretty relevant considering, again, fiduciary trust is one of these tenets of interest that is specifically named in Kevin Ryan's article. So let's put this on the record, because this is an important part of 9/11 truth that is gradually getting memory hold as people move further and further away and stop talking about this important information. So let's put it back here on the record with Scott Forbes and Gary, no relation, Corbett.
Okay, I worked in the World Trade Center from 98 until 9/11 in 2001. My interest in the whole issue of a conspiracy for 9/11 is based on fact that there was a power down in the South Tower on the weekend of the 8th and 9th of September. I worked on it. I was in the tower at the time, so I know for a fact it occurred, along with many colleagues.
My name's Gary Corbett. I worked for Fiduciary Trust, recently merged with Franklin Templeton shortly before 9/11. I was a computer operator on the night shift, Monday night into Tuesday. The previous weekend, there had been a power down. When the power was turned on, there's a lot of problems for all companies within the complex who had computer systems, simply because the mainframes weren't talking to the servers, to the front-end servers, and vice versa. And what made the day really tragic is you had a lot of the technical people, data processing types, coming in early, who wouldn't have been there till 9 or 10 o'clock. They were brought in early, and then you had the admin types coming in because, you know, the trial balances and the books weren't complete. The reason I stopped, I saw the sign, 9/11 was an inside job. Again, because of the power down, there was a complete breakdown of security that weekend. I was working on the 97th floor, and supposedly, no, Fiduciary had a vault where there was gold, some kind of agreement with J.P. Morgan, or, you know, something someone of my level wouldn't understand. We had guided tours coming into secured areas by mistake and nobody picking it up because there's no intrusion alarms or anything else. And the one thing besides the loss of coworkers that day that I'll never forget, the CEO or whatever she was, Ann Tatlock, just happened to be out of town, and, you know, within moments after the collapse, you know, made the statement to the stockholders and the other people that we lost a lot of people, but don't worry about them. They were only clerks.
So we worked on the Saturday morning, shutting everything down, handed over to the Port Authority, and it was handed back to us on the Sunday afternoon. So there was a period of probably 30 hours where there was no power. Right, and it wouldn't have just have affected camera security. it would have affected all the secure systems on doors for either key locks or security badges and so on to undo them. They weren't working because they're all powered by electricity, so there was no power, there was no backup system, therefore they were all open.
The power down started like Friday night close of business, gradually into Saturday morning. It was the essential areas only. Fiduciary Trust was completely down. We were just there on guard duty. We were doing nothing because the power was off. The power came on probably sometime, I'm guessing, about 4 o'clock. Sunday afternoon.
In retrospect, of course, looking back, you think about everything that went on. The fact of the power down in itself was unusual. The fact that there were visitors to the tower, many in overalls, like engineers of some kind, wandering around the floors, carrying toolboxes and cables and so on. At the time, wasn't suspicious of it, didn't think anything of it. I guess my big thing is I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't like to be labelled like that. The information that I want acknowledged is factual, plain and simple. So, you know, I don't have any clarion call for anybody. I just want the truth to be acknowledged and explained. When I tried to register the information with the 9/11 Commission thereafter, and when I pursued it with the Port Authority to acknowledge it, and the information was not registered by the 9/11 Commission, and it was not acknowledged by the Port Authority and is now denied by the Port Authority that the power down took place.
Once again, that is Scott Forbes and Gary Corbett both independently confirming that power down that took place in at least the upper floors of the South Tower the weekend before 9/11. And again, I think that's a relevant piece of information that has been largely neglected and forgotten. And the fact that it's at least corroborated by two sources. However, the 9/11 Commission, of course, failed to look into this event. And it's basically been largely a memory hold by this point. So if anyone can dig up any more information about this story, if there's anything else that has occurred in the intervening couple of decades since those flurry of interviews with Forbes and Corbett, I would be interested. I would be very interested to see that because it's an interesting story. Again, it's one of those stories, one of many, 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 many stories that are interesting and that hopefully can be verified or debunked one way or the other. But once you do that, well, then there's still a lot more information to go through, because as I say, we've just breezed through part one, tenets of the demolition access to the WTC towers article. But as I talked about before, there was part two on security, in which essentially in the second essay, we'll review the security organizations and contractors that had access to the Twin Towers. Due to the complete rebuilding of the security systems at the WTC complex after the 1993 bombing, it is clear that a plan could have been developed at that time to allow access to those who might desire to bring the towers down. The few private security companies involved could have enabled such access by installing loopholes or providing access keys to anyone, including demolition contractors. Other WTC contractors, particularly those hired to complete certain electrical or construction-related upgrades, could have been involved in the installation of demolition devices or related infrastructure. The primary security companies might have also controlled access to certain areas in order to prevent others from discovering what was going on. Additionally, other authoritative groups, for example, Silverstein Properties and local government offices, could have facilitated the plan. And then, in like style, he goes through in a meticulous, well-documented manner and goes through, again, with dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of more references, all of the different security companies and how they relate to all of this. Then he gets into part three of Demolition Access to the WTC Towers, Carlisle, Kissinger, Sake, and Halliburton, a 9/11 convergence, in which he goes through these characters and how they are related to each other and to the events of 9/11. So he talks about after the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, a company called Stratesec or Securicom was responsible for the overall integration of the new security system designed by Kroll Associates. Stratesec had a small board of directors that included retired Air Force General James Abramson, Marvin Bush, the brother of George W. Bush, and Wirt Walker III, a cousin of the Bush brothers. Wow, what a small world. Other directors included Charles Archer, former assistant director in charge of the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Services Division, and Yusef Saud al-Sabah, a member of the Kuwaiti royal family. And then he goes on to talk about QAM Corp, Kuwaiti American Corporation, and on and on, and into the Carlyle Group and its connections, and into SAIC, S-A-I-C, and then into Halliburton and BCCI, and then into Kissinger and his connections to all these people. Again, dozens more references to go through. And then once you get through that, you're into part four of this exploration on the cleanup, because it's not just about who had access before the fact, but also who had access after the fact to dispose of any incriminating evidence. And as it turns out, well, in addition to the actual placement of explosives, those involved would need to clean up any evidence of explosives remaining at the site. In the final essay of a multi-part series, it will be seen that certain people had the means, opportunity, and motive to destroy such evidence at Ground Zero, and that something was being hidden after the buildings fell. And once again, there's a wild ride in this story about the Office of Emergency Management that Rudy Giuliani was running, obviously, as mayor of New York at that time, with the help of some well-connected friends, Jerome Hauer and others. And Bernard Carrick makes an appearance in this story. The organized crime-affiliated construction companies and others that were involved in the cleanup, the FBI and what it was doing in terms of destroying, tampering, stealing evidence at the Fresh Kills landfill where the debris was being sorted. Again, there's so much information in this, and again, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens, or should I say, over 100 references. So, again, it's just an incredible amount of data in this four-article series that goes some way towards answering ANCAP 94's original question. So, boy, you got some reading cut out for you if you're interested in this. Now, this is what 9/11 research actually looks like. It's not the conspiratainment popcorn 5-minute YouTube video with the spooky music. It's reading through dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of documents and putting names and faces together and drawing mental maps of how people connect and how where people were physically located in various towers and things like this. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of effort, but that's what this 9/11 research is really like if you really want to start drilling down on it. If you really want to start asking the how question. But I hope, anyway, that this will be a good starting point for that investigation. Of course, it is not the ending point. It is not the end-all be-all, but it hopefully gets you thinking along those lines and gives you some good food for thought and some good links to follow and names to follow up with. But once you're done with that, not only to ANCAP 94, but to, again, anyone else in the audience who has only come on board with reality in recent years and may not be an old hand at 9/11 truth and may be interested in the subject, might I suggest that it is also worth your time to start looking into all of those subjects surrounding what is typically what the public has been programmed to equate with 9/11 truth. 9/11 truth equals explosions. Buildings falling down equals 9/11 truth. That is all there is to 9/11 truth. That is the whole thing that the entire movement is about. That is the only thing you're allowed to think about. Well, anyway, there's lots of researchers talking about that, and so I have attempted in my research over the years to talk about, any of the million other subjects and connections that come up when we're exploring what really happened on 9/11, why it happened, which seems as important to answer as the specifics of the technicalities of the how. I'm not sure knowing precisely what particular species of exotic weaponry or explosive device or what have you was involved will really solve all the world's problems. But knowing about false flag terrorism, how it operates, why these plots are put in place, can really break the spell that these false flag attacks have on the general public. So on that note, I would suggest If you are interested in 9/11 truth, perhaps you can, well, I mean, again, start at the Corbett Report archives and branch out from there. I have talked to Kevin Ryan on a number of different occasions about a lot of different things that he has talked about. His book on Another 19, talking about, which was the origin of my 9/11 Suspects series and an inspiration for that series. So I've talked to him about that book. I've talked to him about his work on the Secret Service and what it was doing on 9/11, about the Saudi-Saudi connection and how that's used as a geopolitical tool, etc. I've talked to him on a number of different occasions, so I suggest you check in the archives for my Kevin Ryan conversations. You might want to start. I'm sure you've already seen my 9/11 conspiracy theory video, because that is probably the most famous video that I've ever done. But did you know there's also a hyperlinked transcript where you can follow and find out about every single thing that I'm mentioning in an offhand way there? Because there is, and so you can. And then once you get into it, you can start getting into 9/11 whistleblowers and 9/11 trillions. And oh, hey, why not my False Flags documentary? My 5.5-hour documentary on a million things to do pre-9/11, post-9/11, 9/11 itself, with regards to Al-Qaeda, what that organization is, how it operates, the characters that have populated that that entity over the years. If you dive deep enough into the archives, you'll even find, I mean, things that even I have forgotten I've done. I was just looking at this the other day. Interview 741 with Jeremy Rees, identifying the real 9/11 suspects. Again, big deep dive into some of these names and characters and companies and associations and correlations that we've just looked at in this exploration today. So there's a lot. There is a lot of information to go through. But I think it is important not simply and not solely because of the day of September 11th, 2001 itself. That is a day in history that was obviously very interesting for a lot of reasons, but primarily because it branches out forward and backward in time to all sorts of other incredibly important topics that continue to shape our world to this day, about false flag terrorism and intelligence operations and the Homeland Security state and the never-ending wars of aggression and the military-industrial complex and so many other aspects of our life that I think it is important. And I just hope people will start to branch out and explore some of this information. Having said that, it is sweltering hot in here, so I'm going to go turn an air conditioner or a fan on, and I'll exhort you guys to start reading through these articles and exploring the links, and get back to me in a few months when you've gotten through it all, and maybe we'll talk some more then. At any rate, that's going to do it for today. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com.